Imagine for a second that you're a trader at a major Wall Street firm. You execute this massive multi-million dollar institutional trade.
Right.
And the price is perfect. The client is thrilled. The clearing goes off without a hitch. Money changes hands exactly as it should. But because the clock on your trading terminal was out of sync with an atomic clock in Colorado by literally a fraction of a second.
Just like at the blink of an eye.
Yeah, literally a blink of an eye. Regulators flag your desk for a market manipulation violation.
Oh, man.
And suddenly your supervising principal is like fighting to keep their license. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're dissecting the invisible tripwires of Series 24 trade reporting.
It's a dense one.
It is. But before we fall down this regulatory rabbit hole, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. If you're grinding for the Series 24, they've got this full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. So check it out at CertFuel.com.
Awesome.
So yeah, cracking function 4 of this Series 24 exam, trade reporting. It's notoriously difficult because it feels like this just tidal wave of acronyms and arbitrary time limits.
Yeah.
So our mission today is to decode it.
You're going
to learn it, retain it, and apply it. We're going to focus heavily on the mechanical why behind the rules and the brutal gotchas that exam writers just love to throw at you.
It really is the only way to make this material stick. I mean, if you approach function 4 by just trying to brute force and memorize the fine RA rulebook, the exam will absolutely obliterate you.
Right.
If they throw a slightly modified scenario at you, you're done.
Yeah.
Because the writers are incredibly skilled at writing questions where every single answer looks legally plausible. But if you understand the underlying market microstructure, like why FINRA or the SEC actually built the plumbing the way they did.
What they're trying to prevent.
Exactly. What historical disasters they were trying to stop. Then you become bulletproof.
I love that. So to help us navigate this plumbing, I want to introduce a recurring cast of characters that we'll use to kind of stress test these rules today.
Okay, let's hear them.
First, we have Frantic Fiona. She's an equities trader. She means well, but her desk is just pure chaos.
Oh, I know the type.
Yeah, she's always rushing against the clock, clicking the wrong drop-down menus, and generally just giving her compliance department heartburn.
Absolutely.
Then we've got Devious Dan. He's this sneaky broker who's actively trying to game the system, always looking for ways to cover his tracks, hide unprofitable trades by, you know, flipping them into different accounts and manipulating the tape.
The worst.
The absolute worst. And finally, we have Penny Stock Paul. He's a retail client who is just absolutely obsessed with buying the sketchiest, most illiquid, like sub-$5 shell companies he can find on the internet.
I mean, from a supervisory perspective, that is a nightmare roster.
Complete nightmare.
But for unpacking the Series 24, they are literally the perfect stress test. Because every rule we're about to talk about was essentially written to either fix Fiona's sloppy mistakes, catch Dan's deliberate fraud, or protect Paul from his own terrible financial instincts.
Exactly. So let's jump right into the geography of it all, because before we can even talk about time limits or manipulation, you have to know where to actually send a trade report. I assume FINRA doesn't just have one giant centralized database where everyone dumps their trades.
Far from it. If they did that, the data would be utterly useless for surveillance.
Makes sense.
Right. Different financial products have entirely different market structures, different liquidity profiles, and radically different regulatory concerns. I mean, a highly liquid share of Apple trading 10,000 times a second is fundamentally different from like an obscure municipal bond that trades once a month.
Right.
So because of that, FINRA has segmented the plumbing into 4 highly specific reporting facilities.
Okay, so I try to visualize these reporting facilities as exclusive nightclubs in a massive city. You can't just walk off the street, walk up to any door, and get inside. You need the right profile for the venue, and more importantly, you need a specific VIP pass for that exact club.
I like that.
So in a regulatory world, that VIP pass is a participation agreement. So if I'm a broker dealer, do I just sign one master agreement with FINRA and get into all the clubs?
You do not.
Yeah.
No, you need a separate specific participation agreement for each individual facility you want to report to. So if you're an equities shop that suddenly decides to start trading corporate bonds, you can't just route those bond trades using your existing equity agreement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You have to go to FINRA, sign the specific agreement for the bond facility, test your systems with them, and get approved before you can submit a single report.
Got it. Okay, so let's map out the 4 clubs on this block so we know exactly who is allowed through which door. The first and probably the biggest is the TRF, the Trade Reporting Facility. I know this is for NMS stocks, National Market System stocks, which basically means listed equities like NYSE or NASDAQ.
Yeah.
But it's not for all NMS trades, right? It's specifically for when they're executed off exchange.
That is the critical distinction, yeah. If two broker dealers execute a trade for like 10,000 shares of Microsoft directly on the NASDAQ exchange floor, NASDAQ systems capture that data instantly.
Oh, okay.
And they report it to the consolidated tape so the broker dealers don't have to report it.
Right, because the exchange already did it.
Exactly. The TRF exists specifically for the massive volume of trades that happen in the shadows, meaning like over the counter or internal to a broker dealer or in a dark pool.
Mm.
If you match a buyer and seller away from the lit exchange, FINR still needs that data to give the public an accurate picture. So that dark off-exchange NMS volume goes to the TRF.
Okay, so the TRF is the destination for off-exchange listed stocks. Then right next door, we have the ADF,
yeah.
The Alternative Display Facility. This one always trips me up because it seems sort of redundant.
Yeah.
What is the ADF doing that the TRF isn't?
Well, the ADF is a very unique hybrid. The TRF, as the name implies, it only takes trade reports. It's just a reporting engine. The ADF, on the other hand, takes trade reports and it displays quotes for NMS stocks traded over the counter.
Oh, so it's two-sided.
Yeah, it was built as an alternative for market participants like electronic communications networks or ECNs who wanted a place to post their bids and offers publicly without having to become a full-fledged national exchange.
Right.
So if a firm is actively quoting an NMS stock OTC and executing trades against those quotes, they might use the ADF.
Okay, so the TRF and ADF are like the upscale clubs for the listed, highly regulated NMS stocks.
Right.
Then we walk a little further down the street and we find the ORF, the OTC reporting facility. This feels like the club with a much looser dress code.
Oh, it is the Wild West by comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the ORF handles trade reporting for OTC equities. These are your non-NMS stocks.
So no NASDAQ?
No. We're talking about the pink sheets,
mm-hmm.
the OTC bulletin board securities, foreign equities that aren't listed in the U.S., and restricted equities securities.
Okay.
These are companies that are too small or too new or maybe too financially unstable to meet the listing requirements of the big exchanges.
Okay, let's put frantic Fiona to the test here. Let's say Fiona is working her desk, moving incredibly fast. She executes an OTC pink sheet trade for one of Penny Stockpall's crazy mining companies.
Classic Fiona.
Yeah. But in her rush, she accidentally routes the trade report to the TRF instead of the ORF. Does the system just quietly reroute it for her?
No. It rejects it entirely, and she has just committed a distinct reportable violation.
Really?
Yeah. And the exam writers love testing this boundary. You cannot send a non-NMS stock to the TRF, and conversely, you can't send a listed NMS stock to the ORF.
Got it.
Misrouting a trade isn't just a harmless typo, right? It distorts the respective data feeds and triggers exception reports at FINRA. So Fiona's firm would have to explain to a regulator why their routing tables are completely broken.
So she gets thrown out by the bouncer and gets a regulatory citation. Cool.
Exactly.
That brings us to the fourth club on our map, TRACE, the Trade Reporting and Compliance Engine. This one's entirely separate from the equities world, right?
Mm-hmm.
TRACE is exclusively for eligible debt securities. So corporate bonds agency debt, U.S. Treasuries, securitized products.
Yes. And this is where we have to highlight a massive trap for anyone studying for the Series 24.
I'll lay it on us.
They will try to blur the lines between equity and debt facilities.
Okay, let's run a scenario then. Fiona finally calms down on the equities desk. Later that afternoon, she covers for a colleague and executes a trade for a corporate bond issued by Ford. She's used to the ORF for off-exchange stuff, so she routes the bond trade to the ORF. Obviously, that's a violation because ORF is strictly for OTC equities. Debt always goes to TRACE. But here's the real curve, Bill. What if she executes a trade for a municipal bond? Take a second to think about this. Does she route that to TRACE?
She does not. And if you choose TRACE on the exam for municipal bond, you will lose the point.
Wow.
FACE trade reporting facilities do not handle municipal securities. Municipal bond trades must be reported to the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, specifically through their RTRS system.
Right, the real-time transaction reporting system.
Exactly. TRACE is for corporate and government debt, not munis. And the exam writers will almost certainly offer TRACE as this alluring decoy answer for a municipal bond question.
That is a phenomenal distinction to highlight. Municipal bonds are their own sovereign territory. Let's stay with the execution side for a moment and talk about alternative trading systems, or ATSs, like dark pools. Usually an ATS acts as the executing party in a trade, right? They match the buyer and the seller in their dark pool. So logically, the ATS is responsible for reporting that trade to the TRF or the ORF. But I was reading that FANRA allows for something called an ATS reporting exemption, which shifts that duty. How does that work?
Yeah, so the ATS exemption exists because many broker-dealers who subscribe to a dark pool prefer to just handle their own reporting. They already have the infrastructure built out, and they want to integrate the reporting into their own middle office flow rather than relying on the ATS.
Makes sense.
So FINRA allows the ATS and the subscriber to sign a formal agreement that exempts the ATS from reporting. It shifts the legal obligation entirely onto the executing party member subscriber.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here. What if that exemption agreement is fully signed and in place, but a specific trade occurs in the dark pool, where one side is a FINRA member broker dealer, but the counterparty is a non-member, like maybe a massive institutional hedge fund that isn't registered as a broker dealer? Does the member firm still report it under the exemption?
No, the exemption immediately dies for that specific trade.
Real.
Yeah, this is a rigid condition of the rule. For the ATS reporting exemption to be valid on any given transaction, both subscribers involved in the execution must be FINRA members.
But why does FINRA care if both are members? If the one member firm is willing to take on the reporting burden, shouldn't FINRA just be happy someone is doing it?
It comes down to regulatory jurisdiction and tape integrity. If a non-member is involved, FINRA has no direct authority over them. So if the reporting gets botched, FINRA can't easily investigate or discipline a non-member. Therefore, when a non-member is one of the parties, FINRA revokes the exemption and forces the ATS itself to report the trade. The ATS is a FINRA member, so FINRA maintains a clean chain of jurisdiction over the data.
Got it.
So if you see a question about the ATS exemption, your eyes should immediately scan the prompt to confirm that both parties are member broker dealers.
Great tip. Okay, so we understand the geography now.
Yeah,
we know TRF is for off-exchange listed, ORF is for unlisted OTC, TRACE is for debt, and munis go to the MSRB. Now that we know which mailbox to drop the report into, we have to talk about the clock. How fast does Fiona have to run to the mailbox?
The speed requirements are entirely dictated by the asset class, and they are incredibly tight. For the equity facilities, the TRF, the ADF, and the ORF, the standard reporting window during normal market hours is exactly 10 seconds.
Yeah.
You have 10 seconds from the exact moment of execution to get that formatted report submitted to the facility.
10 seconds from execution. Normal market hours being 9:30 a.m. to 4:00 p.m. Eastern. That is breathtakingly fast if you're doing anything manually.
Oh, yeah.
But what about TRACE? What about the debt side?
TRACE provides a much wider window. For most TRACE-eligible corporate and agency debt, the rule requires reporting as soon as practicable, but no later than 15 minutes.
Wait, 15 minutes feels like an absolute luxury compared to a 10-second sprint.
Yeah.
I mean, I can go grab a coffee in 15 minutes. Why is there such a massive discrepancy between equities and debt? Why does Fiona have to sweat bullets over 10 seconds for a stock, but gets a 15-minute breather for a bond?
Well, it's entirely a function of market microstructure and how these assets actually trade in the real world. Equity trading today is almost entirely electronic. It's highly automated, driven by algorithms, smart order routers, matching engines. A trade happens in microseconds.
Right.
And the reporting system is hardwired into the execution system. So in the equity world, 10 seconds is actually an eternity for a computer.
Right. The computer could report it 10,000 times before the 10 seconds are up.
Exactly. But bond trading is vastly different. While electronic platforms are growing, a huge percentage of corporate bond trading is still highly manual.
Okay.
It involves traders calling each other on the phone, negotiating bespoke sizes over chat networks, manually typing up order tickets. The liquidity is much lower, and the transactions are more complex.
So 10 seconds just isn't possible.
Right. Forcing a 10-second reporting window on a manually negotiated, illiquid corporate bond trade simply isn't technologically or physically feasible for the industry yet. So FINRA gives them 15 minutes.
Okay, that structural context makes it so much easier to remember. Let's stress test the 10-second equity rule. Let's say Fiona's having a rough morning. She executes an off-exchange trade in Microsoft. Her systems glitch, she gets distracted, and she finally submits the trade report to the TRF at exactly 15 seconds after execution. Think about this. Does the TRF look at the timestamp, realize it's late, and just reject the trade entirely?
It does not reject it. FINRA desperately wants and needs that market data to maintain an accurate consolidated tape, even if it arrives late. So the TRF accepts the report, but it automatically slaps a giant scarlet letter L on it. It appends a late modifier to the trade report, and that modifier is broadcast to the entire public tape.
So the whole world sees that Fiona was late.
The whole world sees it, but more importantly, FINRA's surveillance systems see it. And this brings us to a major regulatory framework, which is the timely transaction reporting standard.
If Fiona is late once because she sneezed and clicked the wrong button, is Fininari going to pull her license?
No, a single isolated late report is a minor operational hiccup. But Fininari is looking for systemic issues. They care deeply if Fiona's desk is consistently 11 seconds late day after day.
Right.
A pattern of late reports, even if they miss the window by just 1 or 2 seconds, indicates that the firm's automated systems are broken or their supervisory procedures are fundamentally flawed. That pattern is a severe standalone violation. Firms have been fined heavily and faced suspensions not for a single missed deadline, but for a systemic failure to maintain the 10-second standard.
That makes me wonder about the logistics of Fininari's surveillance. A major firm might process millions of trades a day across dozens of different trading desks. If Fininari sees a cluster of late reports coming from a massive global bank, how do they know it's specifically Fiona's desk in the equities division that's dropping the ball and not the derivatives desk or like the proprietary trading desk?
That is where MPDs come into play, market participant identifiers. You can think of an MPID as a highly specific caller ID for a broker dealer. A firm doesn't just have one massive anonymous pipe connected to the TRF. They are allowed to use multiple MPIDs to segment and map their reporting by business unit or specific trading desk.
So the main equities desk might have the MPID EQTY, while the convertible arbitrage desk operates under KeyNV and the algorithmic routing desk uses ALGO.
Exactly. And the regulatory requirement here is very strict. The firm must maintain a comprehensive, up-to-date roster that maps every single MPID, not just to a desk, but to a specific named supervising principal.
Oh, so when Fininari's systems detect a sudden spike in late reports, they don't just call the firm's general compliance hotline and say, hey, someone in your building is late.
Hmm.
They look at the caller ID, they check the roster, and they call the specific principal in charge of EQTY and demand to know why their desk is failing.
Precisely. It establishes direct accountability. The supervisor cannot claim ignorance because their name is legally bound to that data stream.
Wow.
And speaking of accountability, let's highlight another exam trap regarding timeframes. The exam will almost certainly try to swap the equity and debt windows to see if you're paying attention.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, they'll present a scenario where an OTC pink sheet equity trade is executed and ask if it needs to be reported in 15 minutes. Or they'll ask if a TRACE-eligible corporate bond needs to be reported in 10 seconds.
I can see how someone moving too fast on the exam would fall for that. Equities are fast 10 seconds. Debt is slow 15 minutes. Never mix the streams. Now let's talk about what happens when a trade gets to the facility under the wire. Fiona got her trade into the TRF in 9 seconds. Great. But she's not done. A trade report is much more than just a price and a share quantity. It has to be heavily tagged with modifiers. It's like labeling your baggage before it goes on an airplane. If you don't put the right tags on it, it causes chaos.
Modifiers are the metadata of the market, and the most scrutinized, heavily tested tags on the Series 24 are the short sale modifiers. This is where Regulation SHO intersects directly with trade reporting.
Okay.
If an order is executed as a short sale, the resulting trade report must be explicitly marked with a short modifier. If it qualifies for an exemption under Reg SHO, it must be marked short exempt.
Let's dig into the why here. Why does Fininari demand that the public tape explicitly identify short sales? Why does the market care if the seller is long or short as long as the shares are delivered?
It's entirely about market transparency and understanding the nature of selling pressure. Think back to the 2008 financial crisis when bank stocks were in freefall. Regulators and the public need to know the anatomy of a crash.
Right.
If a stock is tanking, the market needs to know, is the selling volume coming from panicked long investors who are liquidating assets they already own, or is it being driven by aggressive short sellers who are borrowing millions of shares specifically to drive the price into the ground? The short sale modifier illuminates that dynamic in real time.
That makes perfect sense. So what if frantic Fiona executes a short sale, but because she's rushing to beat that 10-second clock, she forgets to attach the short modifier to the TRF report?
Then she has just committed two separate violations on a single trade. First, she violated Reg SHO for failing to properly mark the order ticket internally. Second, she violated the Fininari trade reporting rules for submitting an inaccurate, improperly modified report to the consolidated tape.
Double whammy.
Yeah, the violations stack and the fines multiply.
Speaking of stacking, I noticed in the study materials that the modifiers themselves can stack on a single report.
Absolutely. A single trade report can and often must carry multiple modifiers. For example, a trade can be marked late and short simultaneously.
If I'm a supervising principal, Reviewing Exception reports a trade that is both late and short. Seems like a massive red flag.
It is the ultimate red flag. If a desk has a high frequency of trades bearing that specific combination, a regulator is going to assume the worst. They won't just assume the desk is slow at data entry. They'll suspect that the desk is deliberately delaying the reporting of massive short sales to hide their bearish activity from the broader market while they build their position.
Oh.
They're using the latency to mask their footprint.
Which sounds exactly like a strategy Devious Dan would employ. That brings us to a fascinating area, which is the anti-manipulation standard on the reporting side. Let's pose a scenario. Devious Dan holds a massive, highly illiquid position in a microcap stock. He wants to attract retail buyers, so he needs the stock to look vibrant and heavily traded. He coordinates with an affiliated hedge fund, and they start doing wash trades. Dan sells 50,000 shares to the affiliate, and 2 minutes later, the affiliate sells 50,000 shares back to Dan at the exact same price. They aren't trying to move the bid or the ask, they're just generating massive fake trading volume. Think about it. If Finery catches him, is he charged with a quoting violation or a reporting violation?
He is charged with a reporting violation.
Yeah.
He's maliciously manipulating the consolidated tape by injecting fictitious volume. He's not manipulating the bid and ask quotes.
That is a brilliant distinction. When studying Unit 13 of the Series 24, you spend a lot of time on quoting side rules. Things like disruptive quoting spoofing or layering the order book to trick algorithms. But Function 4 is all about the reporting side. Using coordinated wash trades to distort the volume data on the tape is a reporting side manipulation.
Exactly. Or, for instance, simultaneously dominating both sides of the market to create an illusion of tight liquidity when none exists. If the manipulation relies on submitting false or misleading execution data to the TRF, it falls under this rule set.
Let me circle back to the short sale modifiers for a moment, because there is a phrase that always causes confusion. Short exempt. If Devious Dan is marked as short exempt, does that mean he's just magically exempt from all the short sale rules? Like, can he just naked short a stock without locating the shares?
Absolutely not. And that is a classic devastating exam trap. The phrase short exempt is highly specific and narrowly tailored. It only means the trade is exempt from the alternative uptick price test under Reg SHO Rule 201.
Rule 201 being the circuit breaker rule. So if a stock drops 10% in one day, it triggers a circuit breaker. And normally you can only short the stock on an uptick, meaning at a price above the national best bid.
Correct. But certain actors, like a statutory market maker who's stepping in to provide vital liquidity during a panic, can execute a short sale even during a circuit breaker without adhering to the uptick price test. They tag that trade short exempt. But, and this is crucial, it is still fundamentally a short sale. Dan still must comply with the locate requirement before executing, and his clearing firm still must comply with the strict closeout requirements if the trade fails to deliver. He's not exempt from the core mechanics of borrowing and settling the shares.
I can easily see an exam question asking which of the following requirements does a short exempt order bypass and offering the locate requirement as a decoy answer.
Yep.
Do not fall for it. Oh, and one more quick exam trap on modifiers. We've talked about short and short exempt. If Fiona executes a plain old vanilla sale where the client owns the shares free and clear, what modifier does she use for a long sale?
She uses nothing. The absence of a tag is the marking. There's no such thing as a long modifier submitted to the TRF. If a sale hits the tape without a short modifier, it is universally understood to be a long sale.
Okay, up until now, we've been talking intensely about the trade report, the 10 seconds, the TRF, the modifiers. But the trade report is just the final snapshot of the event. It's the period at the end of the sentence. But regulators realized they needed more than just the snapshot. They needed the whole movie. And that brings us to the behind-the-scenes boss of market surveillance. The Consolidated Audit Trail, or CSUTI.
The transition from trade reporting to the CAT is arguably the most significant evolutionary leap in modern market regulation.
What?
To understand CSUTI, you have to understand why it was built. In May 2010, the U.S. markets experienced the flash crash.
Oh, man, I remember that.
Yeah. The Dow Jones plunged nearly 1,000 points in minutes, wiping out $1 trillion in market value, and then rebounded just as violently. When the SEC tried to figure out what happened, they were blind. They had to spend months manually stitching together fragmented audit trails from dozens of different exchanges and broker-dealers trying to track high-frequency trading algorithms that had run amok.
Because every exchange had its own proprietary data format, and there was no central repository that tracked an order from inception to execution.
Exactly. It was a forensic nightmare. The SEC realized they could not regulate a microsecond speed market with week-old fragmented data, so they mandated the creation of the Consolidated Audit Trail. The SEAT is designed to capture the entire life cycle of an order across the entire U.S. market.
I love this analogy for differentiating the two. Trade reporting to the TRF is like an influencer's Instagram post of a beautifully plated meal.
Yeah.
It's the final polished result that everyone sees. The CIT is the unedited, raw kitchen security footage. It shows frantic Fiona taking the initial order from the customer, modifying the size of the order 5 minutes later, routing it to a dark pool, canceling part of it, routing it to the NASDAQ, and finally getting an execution. It captures every single touch point.
And it covers all NMS securities, both equities and listed options, plus OTC equities. Every time an order is created, routed, modified, canceled, or executed, a highly detailed event report must be sent to the CIT.
So if the TRF is a high-stress 10-second sprint, how fast is the CIT? If it's capturing all this raw security footage, is CIT a real-time system? Like, if I'm Fiona, am I streaming my lifecycle events to FINRA live?
Absolutely not. And that is a fundamental difference. The CIT does not require real-time reporting. It is a massive next-day batch process. Broker-dealers aggregate all their millions of lifecycle events for a given trading day format, and the initial submission is due by 8 a.m. Eastern Time on T+1, so the morning after the trade date.
That makes sense. The data volume must be measured in petabytes. You couldn't realistically stream that in real time without breaking the internet. But what if Fiona's firm submits their massive batch file at 8 a.m. and the CIT system kicks back an error report because some of the routing codes are corrupted? Do they get penalized instantly?
No, the system builds in a correction window. If there are errors or unmatched events in that initial T+1 batch, the firm has until 8 a.m. Eastern time on T+3 to correct them and resubmit. So it operates on a batch timeline, but the precision required within that data file is where the true difficulty lies. And that brings us to the most critical, heavily tested technical requirement of the CIT, which is clock synchronization.
Right. If the SEC is going to use this kitchen security footage to reconstruct a flash crash, the timestamps on the footage have to be perfect. If one broker's clock is slightly faster than an exchange's clock, the sequence of events is useless.
Exactly. To solve this, the rules dictate that business computer clocks any system that generates an order event must be synchronized to the NIST atomic clock in Boulder, Colorado. And the tolerance for drift is incredibly tight. It's 50 milliseconds.
50 milliseconds. That is 50 thousandths of a second.
Yes. For manual systems like a human trader manually stamping a physical paper ticket with a time clock, the tolerance is 1 second. But for automated systems, it's 50 milliseconds.
Why is the SEC so obsessed with 50 milliseconds?
Because in modern high-frequency trading, an algorithm can execute thousands of orders across 5 different exchanges in a single second. If a broker's routing system is out of sync with an execution venue system by even 200 milliseconds, the data tells a physically impossible story.
Huh.
When regulators try to line up the timestamps, it looks like time travel. It might show that an order was executed on an exchange 100 milliseconds before the broker-dealer even received it from the client. You cannot run market surveillance on data that violates causality.
Wow. Let me push back with a hypothetical to see how strict this really is. Let's say frantic Fiona's firm is having IT issues. Her computer clock drifts and it becomes out of sync by 250 milliseconds. However, it's a very slow trading day. She doesn't execute any late trades. She doesn't manipulate the market. And all her TRF reports and CAT reports are filed perfectly with no actual execution errors.
Is she still in trouble just for the clock drift?
Yes. This is a massive exam trap. The violation is the clock itself, not the trading activity.
Seriously?
Yeah. Failing to maintain the 50 millisecond synchronization is a standalone strict liability CCAT violation, regardless of whether any actual trades were harmed or reported late. Regulators will fine a firm simply for having drifting clocks during an audit.
Wow. The precision is just non-negotiable. And how long do broker-dealers have to keep this raw atomic clock-synced security footage?
T8 logs and related data must be retained for 5 years, with the record for the first 2 years kept in an easily accessible location.
I'm going to flag that 5-year number for everyone listening, because later on we're going to talk about a 6-year retention rule for something very similar, and the exam loves to test your ability to distinguish them. So CIAT data is 5 years. And obviously the TRF Instagram post and the CIAT security footage have to reconcile. If Fiona reports 10,000 shares to the TRF, but her CIAT lifecycle data only shows an order for 5,000 shares, FINRA's algorithms are going to light up her firm's compliance dashboard, which is a perfect segue into segment 5, processing disputes and fixing mistakes. Because mistakes happen constantly. Let's say the CIAT catches a massive discrepancy in Fiona's reporting, and the counterparty, the broker-dealer on the other side of her trade, is furious. How do these facilities actually process the matching of data, and how do they handle disputes when two firms disagree on the facts of a trade?
Well, from my understanding, there are two main types of trade matches at the facility level: locked-in and unlocked. Locked-in trades seem like the easy automated ones.
They are. A locked-in trade typically comes from an exchange or an automated ATS. Because the matching engine of the venue itself generated the trade, both sides of the execution data are inherently perfectly matched. The facility automatically locks it in. Neither the buyer nor the seller has to manually verify anything.
But an unlocked report is where the drama happens. This is a one-sided submission. Fiona executes an OTC trade and submits her side of the execution data to the TRF. Now, the contraparty has an obligation to look at that report and either accept it or reject it.
I like your earlier analogy of the high school dance proposal.
Exactly. An unlocked trade is like a public proposal. Fiona puts it out there. She submits the data to the TRF, and it's just standing in the cafeteria holding a sign. But until the contraparty explicitly clicks, accept that trade report is just hanging there awkwardly, it is an unconfirmed match. And if the contraparty looks at Fiona's price, disagrees with it, and hits rejecting up, you suddenly have a formal dispute.
And the rules surrounding a rejected trade are heavily tested. If the contraparty rejects the report, Fiona has to act. She must either resolve the dispute by contacting the contraparty, realizing she made a typo and fixing the data, or she has to DK it, formally indicate that she don't knows the trade and considers it invalid. But here is the critical, absolute must-know exam trap. A trade report submitted to the TRF by Fiona that is subsequently rejected by the contraparty is not a completed regulatory report.
Let's underline that. Just because she hits submit within 10 seconds doesn't mean she's safe.
Right. Her regulatory obligation is not fulfilled simply by transmitting the data. She cannot wash her hands of it and say, well, I submitted it, it's their problem now. If it sits in a rejected status, it is an incomplete report, and she is in violation if she doesn't actively shepherd it through the dispute resolution process until it is finally accepted or formally DKD.
Okay, let me throw a wrench into this process to test the boundaries between different systems. Let's say Fiona's TRF report is rejected because of a dispute over a fraction of a cent on the price. The TRF data is broken. But behind the scenes, the clearing firm, the massive entity handling the actual transfer of money in the shares, somehow figures it out and the trade successfully settles. The buyer gets their shares, the seller gets their cash. Does that successful financial settlement automatically fix and close out her broken TRF report?
No. And this is a conceptual framework Eminara absolutely loves to test. You must understand the independence of reporting versus clearing. Clearing is the movement of assets. It is about money and shares changing hands to make the parties whole. Trade reporting is about transparency. It is about the integrity of the public market data tape. They are entirely separate regulatory regimes operating on parallel tracks.
So a trade can settle perfectly at the clearing agency and yet still trigger a massive regulatory fine because it was a reporting violation at the TRF.
Precisely. Breakdowns at one layer do not magically fix the other layer. You can have a flawless clearing process and a catastrophic reporting failure on the exact same trade.
Understood. While we're talking about processing and disputes, what happens if Devious Dan's firm is just chronically non-compliant? Let's say they are constantly manipulating unlocked trades or failing to resolve disputes on the ADF. Can they get kicked out?
Yes. The operator of a facility has the authority to terminate or suspend a member's access if they are egregiously violating the rules. But the key takeaway for the exam is that termination is facility specific.
What does that mean in practice?
It means that if Devious Dan gets his firm kicked off the ADF because of chronic, quote, manipulation, they lose their ADF access. But they do not automatically lose their access to trace to report corporate bond trades, nor do they lose access to the ORF for OTC equities. Each facility enforces its own ecosystem rules and participation agreements.
All right, we are rolling into an area where Devious Dan really shines. Let's talk about hiding the evidence, record keeping, and account designations.
This is where the rules become incredibly prescriptive because they're designed to prevent outright theft and fraud.
Let's build a scenario. Devious Dan executes a massive block trade of a volatile stock for his firm's proprietary trading account. He thinks it's going to moon. Instead, the stock instantly drops 20%. Dan is sitting on a massive loss. He knows he's going to get fired. So he wants to hide the bad trade by quietly going into the system post-execution and changing the account designation, moving the trade out of his proprietary account, and dumping it into the account of an unsuspecting wealthy retail client. FINRA obviously knew brokers would try this.
Which is exactly why the account name change record keeping requirement exists. It is a formidable roadblock against exactly that type of fraud. The rule dictates that any change to an account name or designation on an executed trade, whether you're moving it to a different customer trading account, moving it to a firm error account, or moving it to a proprietary account, requires written principal approval.
And when we say written, it can't just be an email saying, looks good, right?
Correct. The documentation must be formal. The firm must document the specific legitimate reason for the change. For example, trader executed in account A, but the order ticket clearly shows the client requested it in account B. And crucially, the record must include the actual name and signature of the approving principal.
So FINRA is forcing the supervisor to put their own career on the line.
That is the entire why behind the rule. Moving a trade post-execution is the easiest mechanism to steal a profitable trade from a customer or dump a toxic loss onto them. By forcing the principal to sign their name and document the rationale, FINRA eliminates plausible deniability. The supervisor must own the why. If FINRA audits that trade later and determines it was a fraudulent allocation, they won't just ban Devious Dan, they'll go after the principal who signed off on it for failure to supervise or active complicity.
Okay, that makes sense for moving trades between accounts. But what about a simple administrative error? Let's say Dan realizes he typed the wrong price on a TRF report. He typed $50.10 instead of $50.01. It's just a typo. Take a beat and think. Can he just hit backspace with the correct price to save server space and move on? Let's test this. Can you ever simply overwrite an existing trade report?
Never. Overwriting original trade data is a massive, severe books and records violation. The audit trail must be immutable. Error corrections, whether you're submitting a cancel a correction or an as of report for a prior day's trade, must create a second distinct record.
It's exactly like getting a bad tattoo. You can't just magically erase ink from your skin. You have to draw a heavy line through it, put the new correct tattoo right next to it, and keep the receipt from the parlor to show the auditor exactly what happened.
That is a perfect visual. Regulators need to see the original mistake, the action taken to cancel it, and the new corrected entry. You must retain the original flawed report AND, the corrected report in your blotters.
And how long do we have to keep these blotters? Because earlier we talked about CCAT data.
Under SEC Rule 17A3, trade blotters, which contain all this execution and correction data, must be kept for 6 years, with the records for the first 2 years kept in an easily accessible location.
And here's the trap we promised earlier. Does the six-year blotter rule apply to CTAT data?
It does not. And you will almost certainly see a question designed to confuse the two. SEC trade blotters are 6 years. CTAT lifecycle records are 5 years. You have to compartmentalize those two numbers in your memory. CAHE is 5. Blotters are 6.
Okay, we've covered standard listed equities, OTC equities, and corporate debt. Now let's leave the relatively safe confines of standard markets and venture into the absolute Wild West. A place where regulators demand an extreme, almost painful amount of supervisory friction because the risk of fraud is so astronomically high. Let's talk about penny stocks.
The penny stock rules under SEC Rule 15G are fascinating because they are intentionally designed to be cumbersome. Regulators know that this sector is rife with boiler rooms, pump and dump schemes, and manipulative actors taking advantage of unsophisticated retail investors. So they built a regulatory framework that acts as a massive speed bump.
Enter penny stock Paul. Paul is convinced he has found the next Apple. It's a company that claims to be mining gold on the dark side of the moon, and it's currently trading at 12 cents a share on the OTC pink sheets. But before we can subject Paul to the rules, we have to define what a penny stock actually is. It's not just any cheap stock, right?
No, the definition of a penny stock is a multi-part statutory test. It is not just about price. To be classified as a penny stock, the security must be an equity. It must be priced under $5 per share. It must not be listed on a national securities exchange like the NYSE or NASDAQ ND. It must fail certain issuer size tests, meaning the company doesn't have significant net tangible assets or a track record of substantial revenue.
Let me throw an exam trap at you based on that definition. Let's say a well-known tech company falls on hard times. Their stock drops to $2 a share, but they maintain their listing on the NASDAQ. Are they suddenly a penny stock, subject to all these extreme rules?
They are not. Being listed on a national exchange acts as a blanket exemption regardless of how low the price drops. The SEC assumes that the listing standards of the NASDAQ provide enough baseline transparency that the extreme penny stock rules aren't necessary. Price is only one part of the test.
But for Paul's 12-cent unlisted OTC moon mining stock with zero revenue, it is unequivocally a penny stock. And you mentioned the SEC wants the buying process to be annoying. The friction is a feature, not a bug. They want Paul to have to jump through flaming hoops so he is forced to stop, think, and truly understand the massive risk he is taking.
Flaming hoop number one is the pre-trade Schedule 15G. This is a highly standardized SEC-mandated risk disclosure document. It explains in blunt terms how illiquid and dangerous penny stocks are. Paul has to receive this document, sign it, and return it to the broker-dealer before the firm can execute his first penny stock trade.
He can't just get it attached to his trade confirmation in the mail a week later.
No, it must be executed prior to the trade. Flaming hoop number two involves, quote, and compensation disclosures. Because these stocks are so illiquid, the spreads can be predatory. So before the trade, the firm has to disclose to Paul the current inside bid and ask, quotes, exactly how much compensation the broker-dealer firm is making on the markup and exactly how much commission the individual representative is pocketing.
They have to show him exactly how much they are bleeding him for the privilege of buying a terrible stock. And then we get to flaming hoop number three, the sales practice requirement. This is the big one.
Before a firm can solicit a penny stock trade, they must explicitly approve the customer's account for penny stock trading in writing by a principal. They must obtain a detailed suitability statement from Paul outlining his financial situation and his investment experience to prove he can actually afford to lose this money. And then comes the ultimate friction point, which is the signed agreement.
Let's test this mechanism because it's a huge exam focus. Penny stock Paul is annoyed by all the paperwork. He tells his broker, Devious Dan, look, I love these garbage stocks. Just give me a comprehensive form that says, I authorize this broker-dealer to buy penny stocks for me whenever you think it's a good idea. Dan gives him a blanket authorization form and Paul signs it. Is Paul finally good to go?
He is not. That blanket agreement is entirely worthless in the eyes of the SEC. The signed agreement for penny stocks must be strictly per trade.
Wait, per trade.
Effort.
Every single time.
Every single time. The written agreement must specify the exact identity of the specific penny stock and the exact quantity of shares he is authorizing. If Paul decides he wants to buy five different penny stocks on Tuesday, he must review and sign five separate specific written agreements. The SEC is forcing him to manually consent to every single highly risky transaction.
The friction is the point. Now, are there any exemptions to this? What if Paul is a seasoned investor?
There are exemptions. The sales practice rules don't apply to institutional investors' transactions not recommended by the broker, so unsolicited trades, or to established customers.
Let me push back on that term. What defines an established customer? What if Paul has held an account at Dan's firm for 10 years? And he has a massive portfolio of blue chip stocks like Apple, Microsoft, and Johnson & Johnson. Is he an established customer who can bypass the penny stock hoops?
He is not an established customer for the purposes of this rule. Tenure alone doesn't matter if he has no penny stock experience. To be legally classified as an established customer and bypass the sales practice requirements, he needs to have held an account with the firm for at least 1 year and made a deposit of funds or securities, or he must hit the 333 rule.
The 333 rule. What is that?
He must have previously made three distinct penny stock purchases on three different days involving three different penny stock issuers. Three buys 3 days, three issuers. If he hasn't demonstrated that specific level of prior engagement with the penny stock market, he has to jump through the flaming hoops.
That is a brilliant mechanical way to remember it. Three buys, 3 days, three issuers. Okay. We have covered an immense amount of ground. We are bringing it all home now with our final segment. We're going to quickly cover a few foundational statutory definitions that act as the gates for many of the rules we just discussed.
It is vital to understand that these definitions are statutory. You cannot just invent your own definitions or slap a title on your desk to try and claim an exemption.
Let's start with the clearing agency. We talked about how clearing is separate from reporting. What exactly constitutes a clearing agency?
A clearing agency is a massive intermediary institution that acts as a central counterparty. They handle the actual delivery of securities, the payment of funds, and the settlement of the trade. The biggest examples you need to know are the NSCC, National Securities Clearing Corporation, the DTC Depository Trust Company, and the OCC for options. They are the underlying plumbing that makes the financial system work.
Next definition is listed. Throughout the rulebook, you see rules that apply only to listed securities.
In the regulatory context, listed specifically and exclusively means registered on a national securities exchange, like the NYSE or the NASDAQ. Being quoted on the OTC bulletin board or the pink sheets does not make a security listed.
And finally, a market maker. This is crucial because market makers get special privileges, like the red SHO short exempt status we discussed earlier during circuit breakers.
Right, but you can't just call yourself a market maker to get those privileges. Statutorily, a market maker is a dealer who holds themselves out as being willing to be buy and sell a specific security for their own account on a regular and continuous basis.
I always think of a true statutory market maker like a seesaw on a playground. If a trading firm only buys a stock, never sells it, they're like a seesaw with a kid on only one end. It just sits there. It doesn't function. To be a market maker, you have to have a kid on both sides. You must provide a two-sided quote. You must be willing to buy A and D, sell regularly and continuously to provide that liquidity.
That is exactly right. If you don't meet that two-sided requirement, you are not a market maker. And if you try to claim a market maker exemption on a trade report, you will be sanctioned.
Okay, my brain is officially full. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from this deep dive so they are fresh in everyone's mind. Number one, the clocks. Equities routed to the TRADF or ORF must be reported in 10 seconds. Debt routed to TRACE gets 15 minutes. Number two, trade processing. Locked-in trades auto-match from an exchange. Unlocked trades require the contraparty to actively accept them, and if they reject, the report is not complete until the dispute is resolved. Number three, the boss CAT. Submissions are due at 8 a.m. Eastern on T+1. Computer clocks must be synced to 50 milliseconds. CSF records are kept for 5 years, while SEC trade plotters are kept for 6 years. Number four, hiding evidence. Error corrections always create a second distinct record. You never, ever overwrite the original report. And number five, the danger zone. Penny stock signed agreements are strictly PR trade specifying identity and quantity unless the client hits the 333 established customer exemption.
That covers the core mechanics and the exam traps brilliantly. But to leave you with something to ponder beyond just passing the Series 24, I want you to think about the sheer unfathomable volume of data FINRA and the SEC are ingesting every single day. Every quote, every 50 millisecond CIAT lifecycle event, every 10 second TRF report across billions of shares. We are rapidly moving toward a regulatory landscape where audits are no longer manual spot checks by human beings sifting through paper blotters looking for devious Dan. Audits are becoming AI-driven pattern recognition systems scanning billions of rows of data in real time. If your firm's MPID mapping is slightly off or your execution clock drifts by a fraction of a second, the algorithm won't just see a harmless operational mistake. It will immediately flag a manipulative pattern and the inquiry will begin automatically. The Matrix is watching.
The Matrix is definitely watching, and it does not care if you were just having a frantic morning. So get those clocks synced to the millisecond. Never try to overwrite your bad tattoos. And for the love of everything, keep frantic Fiona away from the ORF with her listed NMS stocks. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today. Keep grinding on that material, and we will catch you on the next one.